Okay, boker tov, everybody. It's 11 a.m. in Toronto, 4 p.m. in London, England, I believe, since we had, of course, at 6 p.m. in Israel, where Simi Peters is waiting to teach. And we, on behalf of Torah in Motion, we're going to be introducing a new class, beginning of a six-part series, Introduction to Midrash. And we have really one of the experts to teach on the topic. Simi's been teaching, you know, Torah since she made Aliyah 40 years ago. She teaches at Nishmat.
Before.
Since before making Aliyah.
Four years.
Okay. All right. Baruch Hashem. She teaches Matan Nishmat, and she's written a book on Midrash. I understand you're working on book number two.
So yes.
It's a pleasure to welcome her, and we look forward to this series. She will share her screen in a moment. We'll try to post all the sources, and thank you very much, and we look forward to this.
Okay. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to start by saying that one of the difficulties in teaching about Midrash is the fact that it's something with which everyone is familiar. It's something, somebody is not muted. I'm hearing myself. Can we mute that? Everybody check and make sure that you're muted, please. It's one of the difficulties is that people are used to studying, hearing, reading Midrash, especially in secondary sources. Your kids have come home with their Midrash stories from Gan, from school. And Midrash is something that is so ubiquitous. It's so much a part of Jewish scholarship that if you've done any learning, you've had a lot of exposure to it. And what sometimes happens when you have that kind of situation, it's like trying to explain to a fish what water is, right? It's just so ubiquitous. People have a particular sort of almost a definition in their heads about what Midrash is. And unfortunately, often that's mistaken. So I'd like you to take a second, just about a minute, to think about how you would define Midrash. I know that if you saw a Midrash in front of you on the screen or in a class or in a quoted by somebody, you'd recognize it. But what is Midrash? And that's what I want you to think about. If we were in the same room, I'd ask you to write a definition. I'd come around and look at your answers and we could discuss them. Unfortunately, we're not in the same room and it's a big group, so we can't do that. But what a lot of people associate Midrash with is stories. I think that's one of the things that leaps to mind in a lot of people's heads when they hear the term Midrash. Very often when I do this exercise in my classes, that's what I get. People will write down stories. That's what Midrash is. I'm about to offer a very, very different definition of Midrash. The definition of Midrash that I am offering is, I think, going to become more clear when we compare Mishnaic style to Midrashic style, okay? Now, the thing to understand is that the authors of the Mishnah, the Gemara, and the Midrash were all the same people. Chazal wrote in two different styles. One style is the Mishnaic style, and one is the Midrashic style. So what we're going to do now, since Rabbi Kelman has informed me that it's probably best if we take a look at the sources together, I will translate everything. Oh, wait a minute. That's not how you share a screen. Hold on. I have to do that again. I did not just share my screen. Oh, here it is. What we're going to do it now is we are going to look at a text. We're going to make a comparison between two texts on the same source. What I'd like you to do is open your Tanakh to Dvarim Chafa, which is Deuteronomy 26, okay? And we'll just read a few psukim, a few verses, and look at what's, by the way, if anyone does not, I can't read chat and teach at the same time, but if you have a question and I'm not being clear, you can sort of break through, okay? So we're in chapter 26, which is Parshat Ki Tavoh, and Ki Tavoh, when you come into the land, and we're reading from the beginning of the chapter. I'll read and translate. Vayaki tavoel haaretz asher Hashem elokecha noten lecha nachala, and it will be when you come into the land that Hashem your Lord is giving you as an inheritance. Virishta v'yashavta ba, and you inherit it and you settle it. V'lakachta mereshit kol pri ha'adama asher tavim me'altzecha. You will bring of the first of all the fruits of the earth that you will bring from your land, asher Hashem elokecha noten lach, that Hashem your Lord is giving to you, v'samta batene, and you will place it in a basket, v'halachta el hamakom asher yivchar Hashem elokecha l'shaken shmon sham, and you will go to the place that Hashem will choose to cause his name to dwell there. And then we get the statement, you come to the Kohen, and who will be in your days, and you will make a declaration, and you will give him the basket, and he will take the basket. The mitzvah that we are speaking about here is the mitzvah of Bikurim, first fruits, the bringing of first fruits from Eretz Yisrael. I'd like you to look at the page that's Hakdamah Midrash, which is an introduction to Midrash, and you will see before you Mishnah Bikurim, the Mishneic tractate Bikurim. That is to say, the Mishneic presentation of the mitzvah of bringing first fruits. Okay, so let's take a look at it for just a second. Aleph, first. Yesh mevi'im bikurim v'kohen. There are those who bring bikurim and read the declaration in front of the kohen. Mevi'im v'lo kohen. There are people who bring bikurim and don't read the declaration. V'yesh she'enan mevi'im. And there are those who don't bring bikurim. Elo she'enan mevi'in, these are the ones who don't bring first fruits. Hanotel l'toch shelo v'hidrich l'toch shel yachid o shel rabim. Someone who plants in his own field, but then it sort of gets extended into another person's field or into the public domain. V'chein hamavrich mitoch shel yachid o mitoch shel rabim l'toch shelo. And similarly, somebody who pulls a vine or pulls a tree from the individual domain to the public domain, from those places to his own. Meaning, someone who has managed to plant his vine or his tree or whatever so that there are shoots going from his ground into someone else's ground or from someone else's ground into his ground. And basically the Mishnah says, people like that don't bring bikurim. People like that don't bring first fruits. You don't bring first fruits from those trees or vines. Mishnah Bet. Why don't you bring first fruits in that situation? Mishum she'ne'emar, because it is said, reshit bikurei admatcha. This is a quotation from Exodus, which is the second place where the mitzvah of first fruits is mentioned. The first of the first fruits of your land. You can't bring first fruits until all of the plantings are from your land. It's got to be your ground. It's got to be your portion. And then it goes on and says, Ha'arisin v'hachecharot v'hasikrikon v'hagazlan ein mevi'in me'oto atam. Tenant farmers, people who are renting land, people who have poached on other people's land, or thieves, don't bring bikurim, don't bring first fruits for the same reason. She'ne'emar, mishum she'ne'emar, because it is said, reshit bikurei admatcha, the first of the fruits of your land. In other words, you've got to own it to bring it. Let's go on. We're going to do one more Mishnah here. Ein mevi'in, we'll do a little bit of the first one. Ein mevi'in bikurim chutz mishivat haminim. You only bring first fruits of the seven special species, which are uniquely special in Eretz Yisrael. And then it explains what's not included, what is included. And now take a look at Mishnah Dalet. Elu mivin velo korim. These are the people who bring bikurim or bring first fruits, but don't read the declaration in front of the Kohen. For example, a convert to Judaism because he can't say my father's or whatever. Okay, so that is the layout of the first four Mishnaic teachings in the Tractate of Bikurim. Now I want you to compare that to the next source, which is on the following page. This is Sifrei Dvarim. Sifrei is a Midrash Halacha. What do I mean by Midrash Halacha? It is a Midrashic reading of the same thing that the Mishnah discusses. Okay, so let's think about this for a minute. And we will start by going back to the verses. Let's go back to Deuteronomy 26. And we will notice that the Sifrei reads or teaches the laws of first fruits very differently from the Mishnah. What does the Sifrei do? You can either have the Tanakh open in front of you, or you can look at the at your screen, because I've pretty much brought the at least Safariah's version of the Sifrei. I prefer a different one, but this will work. V'hayaki tavo el ha'aretz, and it will be when you come into the land. Ein v'haya ela miyad, and it will be means immediately. Ki tavo el ha'aretz, when you come into the land. Aseh mitzvah ha'amura b'inyan, do the mitzvah which is mentioned here. Shebischara tikanes la'aretz. Because in the merit of doing that mitzvah, you will come into the land. What the Midrash is saying here is, you're being given the land because you will bring bikurim from it, right? And it's the merit of the mitzvah of first fruits, which you will do once you settle the land, that's going to be the reason you'll be able to conquer the land. Okay? Asher Hashem Elokecha, that Hashem your Lord has given to you, that Hashem your Lord has given you. Rabbi Shimon Omer, Prat Le'eber Ha'il. Then Rabbi Shimon says, this excludes the east bank of the Jordan, meaning the other side of the Jordan, that they took by themselves. In other words, you only bring Bikurim. I hear myself. I don't know who's unmuted, but okay. You only bring, you took care of Rabbi Kalman?
Yeah. I try to keep care. Yeah, everybody, please do keep yourself muted. Otherwise, if it comes off, I mute them. But I prefer not to have to do that. Thank you.
Yes, so do I. Okay, so Rabbi Shimon says this excludes the east bank of the Jordan because that was land they took for themselves. It wasn't given to them by God. Okay. Let's skip a little to Dalet, the fourth line, the fourth line here. V'lakachta mereshit kol pri ha'adama, and you will take of the first fruit of all, of the fruit of the land. Yachol kol haperot kulam chayavim bebikurim. Is it possible that all fruits are obligated with bikurim? Talmud lomal, the verse teaches us, mereshit, of the first fruit, v'lo kol reshit, and not all of the first fruit. And then there's a whole discussion about how do we learn which fruits to take from and which not to. Let's skip a little bit to where it says chet, which I'm going to highlight for you here. Okay, so you can see what we're up to. Kol pri, all fruit. Priyata mevi bikurim, you bring first fruits only fruit. Ve'enata mevi yayin v'shemen bikurim, you don't bring wine or oil as first fruits. Okay, this is just a sampling of the Sifrei. I'm going to stop the share now for just a moment. This is just a sampling of the Sifrei. And I want you to consider for a moment, what's the difference between the Mishnah and the Midrash? I think you're probably all smelling a literary difference here or a stylistic difference here. And this is going to be critical for our understanding of what Midrash is. So since, again, we don't have enough time to really explore this, I will tell you what the difference is. The Mishnah starts with, who brings, right? The Mishnah starts with who brings. What does the Midrash start with? The Midrash starts with the verses. Midrash starts with the psukim. The difference between Midrashic style and Mishnaic style is that Mishnaic style is broader and more encyclopedic. Midrashic style is always based upon the words of the biblical text. And that's a critical difference because it determines the organization of the material. It determines the style in which you read the material. And that's what characterizes Midrash. Midrash is always a verse-based teaching. Midrash is always based on a pasuk. The Mishnah may quote psukim, but the Mishnah is based more on Torah Shebal Peh, oral tradition, and those elements, or let's put it this way, the authors of the Midrash, the Mishnah and the Gemara, were all the same people, right? But they chose to write in different styles when they were doing different things. For the discussion of halakha, the Mishnaic style is more flexible and gives them more room to organize the material in a way that can be developed halachically. The Midrashic style, even though there's a lot of Midrash in the Mishnah and in the Gemara, in the Talmud, the Midrashic style is always tied to the biblical text. So if you want to teach someone about the commandment to bring, or the mitzvah of, the laws of bringing first fruits, you're going to want to have more control over how you organize that. The Mishnah is able to start with who brings first fruits because it can organize encyclopedically. The Midrash can't do that because it's always based on the biblical text. So here's my definition for you, and then we're going to talk about some of the other important factors here. Midrash is a style of text study which is always pasuk-based. It's always based on a verse or words from the Tanakh. Right? It is characteristic of the period of Chazal, of the sages of the Talmud, the Talmudic sages, authors of the Mishnah and the Talmud wrote the Midrash, right? And it is a very close reading of the biblical text. In other words, what the Midrash does, if you will notice, for example, we saw, let's put that back up for a moment. If you look at the screen for a moment, Kol Pri, oh, sorry, I didn't share that. I'm a little slow with the whole sharing screen thing. Hang on. If you notice, right, we looked at this. Kol Pri, each fruit, every fruit, priya tamevi, you bring fruit, not wine or oil, right? In other words, the Mishnah could organize that differently. The Midrash has to learn it straight out of the pasuk, okay? And similarly, you know, that's why you don't bring from, let's go back here, where are we? Oh, here it is. Pasuk Bet, hang on. What does the Mishnah do here? Sorry, ladies, gentlemen, everybody. I'm used to teaching women, so if I call you ladies, don't get insulted. It's just, that's what I do. Okay. It says, Asher Hashem Elokecha noten lecha, the first of the fruits of the land that Hashem is giving you, Rabbi Shimon Omer, Prat Le'eber HaYarden, excluding the east bank of the Jordan, Shenatlu Me'atzman, they took it by themselves. So it has to be noten lecha, the one that he gave to you, not one that you took yourselves. Notice that the halacha is derived very closely and tightly out of the words of the verse. Okay. Now, one of the reasons we're looking at this is because Looking at Midrash Halacha gives us an opportunity to think about Midrash differently. This is about as far from the Midrash stories understanding of what Midrash is as you can possibly get, right? So the thing to understand about Midrash is that it's a way of reading, okay? Now, the Midrashim you think of when you think of Midrash are stories or parables or other uses of figurative language, which may make it somewhat confusing. So here again, I want to make it clear that Midrash Halacha and Midrash Agadah, right, which are, we just looked at an example of Midrash Halacha, Midrashic readings of the halachic or the legal psukim of the legal verses in the Torah, and Midrash Agadah, which are Midrashic readings of the narrative verses of the Torah, both use the same style. The difference between them is where are they putting their forensic reading on, right? In other words, when you're reading Genesis, there is almost no halacha in Genesis, which means you're going to be using Midrashic style to do a very close reading of narrative verses, okay? When you're doing Shmot, Devarim, Vayikra, Deuteronomy, for example, like the portion that we just did, you're going to be using that very forensic reading on halachic verses, on verses that deal with Jewish law. Okay? Okay. So I think we're good. I think that's pretty clear. I'm sorry that I can't answer the chats now, but I can't multitask that well. Okay. So what is Midrash Agadah? Midrash Agadah is a close reading of narrative verses of the Tanakh. That's what it is, okay? A close reading of narrative verses of the Tanakh. As you can see, it can sometimes really, get to very high resolutions. You focus on a preposition, or you focus on a suffix, or you focus on, you take it apart into its atoms and you read it that way. So what's the difference between Midrash Agadah and Agadah, right? Because when most people say Midrash, they're talking about Midrash Agadah, not Midrash Halacha. Okay, so here again, I'm going to have to give you a definition. There are two types of teachings that the sages of the Talmud and the Midrash taught, okay? One is Halacha, legal teachings. One is Agadah, anything that is not a legal teaching. So for example, the stories about Rabbi Akiva and Rachel, the stories about the destruction of the temple, arguably some of the discussion of natural history or medicine in the Gemara are non-halachic teachings, right? That's called Agadah, as opposed to Halacha. Halacha is law. Midrash Agadah is a verse-based reading of non-halachic texts. Agadah is a non-halachic text, okay? I hope that's not too confusing, because anybody wanna, we're good? We can go on? Okay. So why is Midrash so hard to understand? Why is Midrash so hard to understand? And here we have to talk about another thing, which is that we're going to have to distinguish Midrash not just from Mishnah, and Midrash Agadah not just from Midrash Halacha. We're going to have to distinguish Midrash from later biblical commentary, okay? Arguably, biblical commentary starts with Rashi. Okay, that's what most of us would say. It probably starts a little bit earlier with the Gaonim, but for our purposes, we're going to say Rashi and the Rishonim. Rashi is the first, what we would call, totally dedicated biblical commentator, right? Okay. Now, a lot of Midrash is, as we have pointed out, looking at the biblical text very, very tightly and very, very closely. And inevitably, that's going to involve commentary. So what's the difference between Midrash and, let's say, Rashi or the Ramban, Nachmanides, or the Ibn Ezra, or some of the other commentators that you have heard of? Okay, what's the difference? I would say there are two differences. And we're going to look at some real texts in a minute so that it's not all just up in the air and definitional, okay? One of the differences is that the scope of Midrash is much broader. The biblical commentators set themselves a particular goal, okay? The particular goal that they set for themselves was, we want to interpret the biblical text. That's what we want to do. Rashi uses the term chutosho mikra, which means the plain sense of the text. And they argue about that. The Ramban, or Nachmanides, argues with Rashi, and the Ibn Ezra, everybody argues with Rashi, by the way. Rashi is the gold standard, and everybody argues with him. Everybody's responding to him or affirming what he says in one way or another. But all of the biblical commentators, starting with Rashi until our day, right, are all claiming or trying to interpret the biblical text. What are the authors of the Midrash doing? Well, the answer is they're doing everything. They are taking the biblical text, and they are squeezing it out and wringing it out and analyzing it in every conceivable way, not only to interpret it, but also to write sermons about it, also to plumb its depths in terms of mysticism or a theology. They are using the biblical text as their personal universe to explore. Okay? In other words, they don't make a rigid distinction between what we would call the plain sense of the text and everything else. In this respect, they're like the Greek philosophers, right? The Greek philosophers, and they were roughly of that period, what did the Greek philosophers do? Their field of study was the universe. And that included everything from biology, or what they thought was chemistry or physics, to ethics, aesthetics, metaphysics, theology, everything, right? And by the way, the scientific age only starts when people start narrowing their focus, right? The Greek philosophers, the same Greek philosopher who asked the question like, what is truth, could also ask a question like, why do beavers build dams? He could ask any question, he could cover any topic, he could go anywhere, right? To understand what Chazal are doing, to understand what the sages of the Talmud, Midrash, and Mishnah are doing, we have to understand that for them, the universe of study is the entire Torah, Tanakh, and the oral Torah. And they can ask any question and go anywhere with that. Anywhere from what does this word mean, to what are the implications of this philosophically, to what are the halachic implications of this, to anything. They go everywhere. That's one difference between them and the later biblical commentators. The second difference, and it's an important difference, is that, and I'm going to use Nachmanides as an example right now. Nachmanides writes his commentary in linear prose argumentation. We recognize, we get it. When we read Nachmanides, we know what to do with Nachmanides because he's going to make his argument the way we would make our argument if we were writing a position paper or a college article or a newspaper article about something. He'll ask a question. He'll give an answer. He will back up his answer. He will write it in strict linear prose argumentation. Well, what do the authors of the Midrash do? The authors of the Midrash write their answers in parable, allegory, story, hyperbole, metaphor. You get the picture? In other words, there are two fundamental differences between the authors of the Midrash and the authors of the later biblical commentary. The authors of the Midrash see the biblical text as extremely broad. They can go anywhere with it, right? And when they want to tell you what something means, they might tell you something, they might explain their meaning by using a parable or a story. They're not going to use prose linear argumentation. Okay? And that very often leads people to dismiss the Midrash because they think it's bubamisis, right? It's fairy tales, it's just stories. It's not. It's a mode of discourse that needs to be unpacked. Okay? And here I would, what I would like to do with you is look at the second sort of part of Hakdama LeMidrash, the introduction to Midrash. And I'd like to actually look with you at a couple of Midrashim to explain what I mean. And here I would like to explain, let's scroll down, and you will see the following here, which is in front of you, you should see Bereshit Rabbah Samachay Tetzayin. This is an excerpt from Genesis Rabbah. Okay, everybody see it? Okay. The story we're looking at, which is one of the most difficult stories and very vexing stories for many of us, is Bereshit Chaf Zayin, Genesis 27. It's the story of Yaakov stealing the blessings from his brother, right? When he goes to his father and he tricks his father, who's blind, into giving him the blessings at the instigation of his mother, right? Okay. Actually, what I would like to do, maybe it would be better if we start with the second paragraph here, which is this one. Okay, everybody see it? Reshit Rabbah Samachay Tetzayin, the second paragraph, not the first one that I highlight, I'll unhighlight it. I just have to tell you that coronavirus has taught me new skills. I am learning how to use Zoom, or sort of learning how to use Zoom. I'm unhighlighting this, okay? No, I'm not. I thought I did, but okay. Take a look at the second paragraph here, okay? And we're going to look at the verses for a moment. Rivka has just called Yaakov in, right? Rebecca's called Jacob in, and she said to him, look, I want you to go to your father and get the blessing. You just gotta do this, okay? You gotta do this. And he understandably is rather horrified at this idea. Take a look at Pasuk Yud Aleph, Genesis 27:11, okay? Genesis 27:11. Vayomer Yaakov el Rivka imo, and Yaakov said to Rivka, his mother, Hen Esav achi ish sa'il, here Esav, my brother, is a hairy man, v'anochi ish chalak, and I am a smooth man. Ulay yemusheni abi, perhaps my father will stroke me, right? Because he's blind, he's going to feel me. V'hayiti be'enav kimitatea, and I will be in his eyes like one who makes fun of him or tricks him. And I will bring upon myself a curse and not a blessing. Now, if the blessing of Yitzchak Avinu, if the blessing of Isaac is very, very important, you certainly don't want a curse from Isaac. Like, no, not. You don't want to risk that. He'd rather give up on getting a blessing than risk getting a curse. And his mother answers him in a very, very strange way. Look at verse 13. And his mother said to him, Your curse is upon me, my son. Achshma bekoli velech kachli. But listen to my voice and go and take for me the kids that I will cook, the goats that I will cook for your father to eat and give you a blessing. Okay. Now, what does Yaakov then do? What does Jacob then do? He goes and he does what his mother tells him to do. He brings her food to prepare and he goes and he goes through the whole charade. Well, there's an interpretive problem here. There's a definite interpretive problem here. What's the interpretive problem? Yaakov expresses a fear that he will be cursed. He doesn't want to be cursed. And his mother says, don't worry about it. Your curse will be on me. What would the proper response of Yaakov be to this? Oh, yeah? How are you going to do that? How can my father's curse be transferred to you instead of to me? If we take an analogy, I mean, that I think makes a lot of sense today, unfortunately. You decide you want me to pick up some sort of CD from your CAT scan for you in a hospital that is, you know, teeming with COVID, right? And you say, go pick up my CAT scan for me. And I say to you, I don't want to go there. I'm not going to go there because I'll get sick. And you say, don't worry, it's on me. I'll take care of it. I'll get sick instead of you. What would you say to such a person? Pick up your own CAT scan. That's what you would say, right? In other words, your curse will be on me. How does that work? What's clear here is there's something missing in the text, and there is something that Yaakov understands from his mother's response that we don't understand from his mother's response. What does the Midrash do? So now I'm going to highlight this so you can see it. It makes a tiny little comment here. Amar Rabbi Yitzchak said, Alay likanes velomar la'avicha, it is upon me to enter and to say to your father, Yaakov tzadik ve'esav rasha. Yaakov is righteous and Esav is wicked. What's going on over here? Your curse will be on me means, according to Rabbi Yitzchak, it is on me to enter and to say to your father, Yaakov is a tzaddik and Esav is a rasha. Yaakov is righteous and Esav is wicked. How does that solve the problem? Well, first of all, I just want you to note that Rabbi Yitzchak does not tell us what he means. He just adds a line to the dialogue. He expands the story. We've got to figure it out. It's not like, for example, I'm going to channel Nachmanides here. I'm going to pretend to be Nachmanides. He doesn't actually say this, but I'm going to write you an answer to this question in the style of Nachmanides. Okay, I'm going to say it to you in the style of Nachmanides. Okay, Nachmanides would say the following. He'd say that Rivka, our matriarch Rivka, understood. Right? And our matriarch Rivka understood that a curse cannot affect a person who is innocent. It can only affect a person who is guilty. Now, Yaakov is afraid of being cursed by his father. But what does Rivka say to him? In this situation, you are innocent, but it is I who am guilty. Because what should I have done? What should I have done? It's my responsibility to go in there and make sure that your father gave the blessing to the right son. I should have gone in and said, Yaakov is righteous and Esav is wicked. Remember, everybody, that Rivka knows she's headed to this impasse here. Because when she was pregnant, what did she find out? She found out that she was carrying two nations in her belly. She found out that one would be righteous and one would be wicked. One would be would take precedence over the older. The younger would be more important than the older one. The birth order was not going to determine who should get the inheritance. right? She never told Yitzchak. She never told her husband. So Rivka is saying, you're not going to get cursed if this goes wrong, because the curse will fall upon me because I'm responsible for this situation. A lie means it's on me. It's my responsibility. Okay. Now, you could argue with this interpretation. You could think it's right. You could think it's wrong. You could go anywhere with this interpretation. But what is clear is that Rabbi Yitzchak sees an interpretive difficulty, and he offers an interpretive solution. Now, it took me 3 minutes to explain it. If you read Rabbi Yitzchak, it took 30 seconds, right? He just expands the dialogue. I had to unpack it for you. And if I were writing this up in the style of the Ramban, in the style of Nachmanides, it would take a page. In fact, I can tell you, it does take a page, because when I wrote my book on Midrash and I had to unpack these kinds of texts into linear argumentation where I could spell out what each implication was, it took a lot of pages because I was writing in Western style. I was not writing in the style of the Midrash. So Midrashic style very often will deal with an interpretive problem, but it conveys the message in language that has to be unpacked. It's not obvious. When you read a parable, you have to figure out what the parable means. It's not being spelled out for you in linear prose argumentation. Just to give you a sense of a different way that the Midrash reads the same material, and it's in the same paragraph, let's go back to our text. I skip the first half of it, right? This part here, which I will now highlight for you again. Okay. Everybody see it? And his, oh no, I didn't share it. I'm sorry. I did it again. I'm sorry. I'll get better at this. I highlighted it, but I didn't share it. I'm not little Miss Technology. What can I tell you? Okay. It is now highlighted. You see it? Vatomer lo imo, and his mother said to him, Alai kililatcha bni, your curse is upon me, my son. Rabbi Abba bar Kahana amar, Rabbi Abba bar Kahana said, Adam shechata, a man who sins, lo imonit halala? It's a question, ladies and gentlemen. Isn't his mother cursed? Meaning, who gets cursed when he sins? Who does everybody curse? Who does everybody blame? His mother. Shene'emar, as it says in Genesis 3, Arura ha'adama ba'avurecha. God says to Adam, the earth is cursed for your sake. Af ata alai kililat chabni. Even you, your curse is upon me or will be upon me. Now, this is not an interpretive reading. It's a much more sermonic reading. According to this, what's happening here? What is Rivka saying to Yitzchak? I'm sorry, to Yaakov, what is she saying? If your father curses me, it curses you, he's really going to curse me because he's going to blame me, right? In other words, when Adam sins, what gets cursed? Adama, the earth. Why? Because Adam comes from the Adama. Adam comes from the earth. You know the expression Mother Earth? Right? The earth is Adam's mother. And when he sinned, what happened? The earth was cursed for his sake. So the same will be between you and me. I'm your mother. I will be cursed. You will not be cursed. Can you see the difference between the two readings? The second reading is much closer to our understanding of an interpretive reading, right? It's much closer to an understanding of what the verse could mean, right, in context. The other one is sort of more a meditation on the nature of sins, curses, and relationships to parents. It's much, much broader and less interpretive reading. Okay, I'm going to stop here for a moment and take some questions, because I have a feeling there's a lot of you here, and I have a feeling that not all of you are necessarily getting what I'm doing here. So,
do you want to go through the question yourself, or do you want me to read the questions for you?
Please help me, Rabbi Kelman. Okay, please help me.
Okay, so let me start. There are quite a number of questions. Very powerful questions. Okay, just let me find it here. Okay, first question here. I'll go in order. If the Mishnah and the Midrash have the same exact authors, why divide it instead of presenting as a whole? And were the editors compilers the same people in the same time period? I'll combine that with a later question: is what was your evidence that it's the same people? That's what somebody wanted to know.
Amar Rabbi X, one in the Mishnah and one in the Midrash. It's the same people.
Good.
It's just that, you know. Amar Rabbi Akiva in the Mishnah. Same guy, same people, same names, same whatever. I think the reason that Chazal wrote in two different styles is because they had different needs, right? In other words, in the Mishnah, they were developing a way of transmitting oral teachings and written teachings about halacha. And they needed something that they could organize to cover everything. And I'll explain why. I didn't really say this, and maybe I should. There are not enough words in the Torah to give us all of the laws of the Torah. So for example, right, all the laws of slaughtering animals. What's the word in the Torah? Vizavachta, and you shall slaughter. You can't write a whole tractate on the laws of slaughtering based on that word, right? I could give other examples, but basically there aren't enough words in the five books of Moses to cover all the halachot. So if you want to teach people all of Jewish law, you can't use the words of the psukim, the words of the verses, to convey that. You also need to have access to case law. You also need to have access to oral Torah. You need to be able to organize it in a coherent way that someone can logically follow. Am I obligated? Am I not obligated? Under what circumstances am I obligated? If you follow the order of the verses, which is what Midrash Halacha does, you're not going to cover everything, and you're not going to necessarily cover it in a way that will make it accessible. And the proof of that is that the Talmud is built off the Mishnah, not off Midrash Halacha. Okay? Did I answer that question, or is there anything left here?
Okay. If you didn't, now people can unmute themselves, but if they have what they want to add. But okay, let's continue. We'll do the unmuting later. How does the interpretive method of Midrash Halacha, as manifest in the Sifrei, compare with the Yud Gimel Midrash Torah Nidresh Behem of Rabban Yishmael? So I'm assuming you touched upon it, distinguishing between Midrash Halacha and Midrash Agadah.
That's right.
I don't know if you wanted this. Maybe in the future you'll talk about that. But okay.
Well, that's a big topic. I don't think I can really address that.
That's what I'm saying. Let me go. Okay, yeah. Somebody would like very quickly, if you'd like to now or in the future, give a short overview of all the different collection of Midrashim, Yalkut Shimoni, Midrash Halacha, Tanchuma. I assume that's what they're referring to, when they were written.
I can refer you to an excellent book in Hebrew, and I can refer you to some excellent works in English. You don't need me for that. It's my feeling. There's a wonderful book by a woman called Anat Reisel, Reish Yud Yud Zayin Lamed, called Mavo HaMidrash. For those of you who read Hebrew, it's a sort of handbook where she goes through the different midrashim, and she tells you what period they are and where they come from, and shows you examples. The Encyclopedia Judaica has a not bad article on the same topic. I hate to say it because I'm even embarrassed to say it, but Rib Google isn't bad either. You know, you can find that material, I think, more easily online. And it's boring, to be honest. It's a little boring. It's not actually, you know, it's not the same as actually studying texts. So okay. I refer you to those.
If you want to send me that, maybe I can send that in an email to people if they want to look at it.
With pleasure.
English, I assume most people prefer reading in English. Some might prefer the Hebrew, but we can send both. If you have a few articles to recommend, I can send leaks, even on Rabbi Google. Rabbi Google is a big Talmud Chacham,
whether we like it or not.
Okay. All right. How do you handle the question? I guess the Rambam here, whatever. If any of the Midrashei Agada are factually and historically true or not?
We're going to talk about that. Okay. We're going to have to talk about that a little bit later.
Interesting question here. In a world where blessings can be sold or stolen, why can't the curses be transferred?
Well, you'd have to explain the mechanism, right? Because why shouldn't the curse go on Yaakov? He's deceiving his father, right? In other words, yes, you could say that blessings and curses can be transferred, but you would have to explain why would Yaakov be willing to risk getting a curse from his father? And the answer seems to be that is going to cover it for him. Okay.
It's also hard to understand how blessings can be transferred. That's not so simple to understand either. Or it's the rights of the blessing. That's what all of them, unfortunately, they all struggle with. What exactly did
Yaakov want? Absolutely. This is a very, very hard chapter. And I like to actually teach. Maybe I'll teach it someday on Torah in Motion. There's a lot to be said about that chapter in Bereshit.
Okay. Yeah. And here's an interesting question. Why did Balaam speak and write in a way that's so hard to understand? Why can't they speak English? Why can't they write in English? You know what I mean?
Important question, and I'm going to address it more further on. I'm going to address that more further on. But the first thing that I will say to you is that this is the quick and dirty answer. Okay, this is the easy answer. They were writing in the style of the ancient Middle East, and in the style of the Tanakh. We changed. They didn't change. In other words, what happened was when God wanted to convey to us all of the messages of the Torah, what does he use? Stories? You want to learn about self-sacrifice and giving yourself totally to God, you read the Akedah, right? The story of the Av Akedat Yitzchak, right? That's the way people spoke in the ancient Near East. I'll use another example. You want to talk about a legal principle or category, you're going to use an expression like an ox that gores. You don't mean just an ox that gores or an obstacle in the public domain. Or any of those things, it's an image of a category, right? So in other words, what Chazal were doing was using the language and the style of philosophical or theological or legal expression that was appropriate to their time. When we became more westernized, we have to go back and translate that into our idiom. But I would add something else as well. And this is something that the Rambam, Maimonides, talks about and will have to be addressed. Six sessions is kind of short, but we're going to cram it all in somehow. If you want to teach philosophy or philosophical idea in philosophical language, you can only speak to philosophy. You can't teach Nachmanides to a 5-year-old, a 6-year-old, or a 10-year-old. Can't. Right? But you can teach a story. And the story may not be understood with complete depth and absolutely as profoundly as possible. But an unsophisticated listener can still grasp something out of the story. So the first time you learn the Akedah when you're in first grade, you have no idea, you don't even get it. You know, you just don't know it at all, right? You learn the Akedah again in eighth grade when you have some Torah background. It starts to take on depth. You learn it again as a teenager with more Torah knowledge. It gets more complex, more profound. You learn it after you're a parent. With even more Torah knowledge and more life experience, the Akedah becomes a massive, massive, powerful, emotionally, intellectually, and spiritually challenging text. You don't get that from a philosophical tract. The goal for the sages was to teach the greatest number of people in a way that would be what they call your shaveh l'chol nefesh, something that would be equally accessible to different people at different levels of awareness, knowledge, and intellectual ability.
Okay.
So that's it.
Very good. Okay, we'll expand on that. Okay, just the Ellen pointing out many Midrashic authors do not appear in the Mishnah. I think that's obvious. Yes, there are rabbis who specialized in Agadah. I think I once noted, I was teaching Pirkei Avot in the summer, there are 22 people, I believe, in Pirkei Avot who appear nowhere else in Shas, just in Pirkei Avot. In other words, they were obviously people specialized in certain areas, but the class, Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Yishmael are both in the Midrash and in the Mishnah.
That's right.
Okay, who wrote the Medrash Rabbah? If you want to answer that, I'll recollect it. I don't think it was one person, of course. But,
okay, the answer to this is also a very, very important, very, very important point. A lot of people wrote Medrash Rabbah, but the redactors of Medrash Rabbah were one generation at a particular time who determined the final form of this oral tradition. Let me see if I can give you perspective on that here. The great works of the Jewish people, starting with Tanakh, except for Torah. Torah is from God. It's all from God, right? Starting with Tanakh, going through the Mishnah, the Midrash, the Talmud, the Haggadah, the Siddur. I don't even know where to stop. Are all compositional texts. When you're dealing with oral traditions, and you're dealing with a very rich and varied Jewish bookshelf, all of the authors, including the Rambam, who tried to actually get rid of this, but he didn't succeed because everybody put it back in. All of the authors of the traditional, great traditional Jewish texts wrote anthologies in the sense that they related to prior authors. They brought oral traditions and written traditions that preceded them. They argue with those traditions and write about them simultaneously. The authors of Midrash Rabbah are all the people who are quoted in Midrash Rabbah and the redactors of Midrash Rabbah who decided on its final written form, right? Did that answer the question or did I confuse you?
I guess I want to know what year was the Midrash Rabbah redacted?
That's a really good question. I believe Anat Reizel talks about that in her book. And that's again, and by the way, I am hopeless at both highlighting and screen sharing, and I'm not good at remembering dates either. So that's not what you're going to get.
Or is Lamala Minasman. Okay. I'm going to combine here two questions. Why would Yaakov be willing to have his mother be cursed? You know, it's very nice. His mother's cursed. I mean, that's not so nice of Yaakov. And number B, very interesting. The fact that Rivka's death is not recorded in the Chumash, but just her her nursemaid, you know, Dvorah, and the Medrash there comments that, of course, that's when Rivka also died. Maybe that's a form of a curse that she doesn't even get mentioned. Interesting. If you want to comment on those two questions.
Very, very briefly, I would say that the question of why Yaakov is willing to do something, you know, this Ein Shliach L'Dvar Aveira, you can't send someone to do a crime for you. The whole question of what happens in Genesis 27 is a profoundly, I can't answer it on one foot, really. I'm not Hillel, you know. It's a profoundly and importantly, it needs to be understood well. And I can't give a, you know, one of those like instant kind of answers to the question. It's part of a larger question about the whole story.
Okay, so you're not saying one way or another if Rivka, that's a curse that she's not mentioned. Leah's death also isn't mentioned in the Chumash. So that's also interesting, right?
Right.
Who gets mentioned, who doesn't? That's other
topic. And under what circumstances, yeah.
Right. It's even Hillel would agree, you can't really learn Kol HaTorah Kula.
No.
He just called him Zil Gemor. I'll give you the start, right. Now go out and do the rest. Okay, perfect timing, 11:59. Thank you very much, and we look forward
pleasure.
To seeing you next week. Thank you.
Are you allowing questions from people unmuting themselves now or no?
Sure.
I'm willing to stick around for a few minutes.
We'll just do for a few minutes because we need a break because Benny Gazun
is
keeping his Sheer and Thielem at 12:15 and want people to get a chance to have a cup of coffee.
Sure. I'll stick around for
they haven't voted
minutes.
Yet, you know, they got to run and vote, those who live in America. And if they haven't,
I have to give it to you at
5 minutes.
8 o'clock my time.
Okay. So but everybody, welcome to Save for Benny Gesundheit. And tomorrow, of course, morning, you know, Marty Lachin continuing biblical commentaries they didn't teach you in yeshiva. So we're doing Midrash, then we're doing Tanakh itself, and then we're doing the Mefarshim. See, we got everything off the group. Okay. I wanted to ask a question.
So a given rabbi member of Chazal who was writing all of these things, would he have distinguished between writing, like let's say Rabbi Akiva. So sometimes what he says is Midrash Halacha. Another time something he says turns out to be a Mishnah. Another time it might be Midrash Agadah. Would he have distinguished between that? Or was that up to the later editors and redactors?
So I think one of the things to understand about oral traditions, because most of this is oral tradition, all of this is oral tradition, is that they float. Okay? Some of it was said in the context of one kind of discussion and gets redacted here. And some of it is said in a different kind of discussion and gets redacted there. So yes, I think the redactors had an extremely big role to play in deciding what went into what, right? So Rabbi Yehuda Nasi and Rabbi Ashi determined the final form of the Mishnah and the Gemara. They were drawing on oral traditions that they float around all the time. And the redactors had the most influence over where did things end up in the canon of Jewish texts. I think that would be, this is not my area of expertise, but I would say that's broadly speaking what we would say. Okay, does that answer?
Yes, thank you.
Yeah.
I have to go. I just wanted to say hello. I don't know if you remember me or not, but I am from back in the days of Harnov. He used to come to your house. Janice is my name, and I just wanted to say hi.
Hi, your face looks familiar, and hi, Toby. How are you, Toby? Toby's a former student from where?
Hi, Simi. So great to see you.
I'm leaving
great
now,
to
bye.
See you too.
Okay. Thank you very much. Right. Okay, go. We'll see you next week, please, God.
Ezra Hashem. Okay.
Thank you very much.